This episode is brought to you by The Syllabus, a nonprofit knowledge discovery service doing artisanal automation. How does that work? Well, they use technology to monitor thousands of sources, and each week, human curators, that is actual people, handpick the best of what's been published on the internet. When you sign up, you get to set up your feed. You'll pick from 6 languages and 60 topics like far-right populism or energy and extractivism, heterodox economics or AI and automation. Everything's there. Each Monday, you'll get a new batch of personalized recommendations. And it's not just podcasts. It's essays and books, academic articles and reports, and even videos. And I believe, dear friends, that American Prestige and even maybe Daniel Bessner himself has been featured on The Syllabus. So check out their website, the-syllabus.com. And there's a hyphen between the and syllabus. That was the dash I said. They offer 2-week free trials. And if you enter Prestige at checkout, you'll get 30% off your first year. And to remember, that's Prestige, P-R-E-S-T-I-G-E. And you enter that at checkout for 30% off your first year.
Let's find a conversation between the soul. Let's conversation between the soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we are excited to bring you the news in the new world order under President Trump. So, Derek, let's get started. Let's talk about Gaza, and let's talk about the ceasefire taking effect. How has that proceeded?
We don't have to start with a... I don't want to say it's a good thing, because it's probably going to run out soon, but at least it's not as depressing as we've been doing.
Yeah, as usual, Gaza will be a little nicer. Weeks.
We can at least say that the ceasefire did come into effect on Sunday. It has held. There have been a couple of instances since then of Israeli forces killing people they claim to have been militants, one Islamic Jihad militant. I think there was another incident on Thursday. I haven't seen the details of, but people who they claim were threatening the Israeli forces that are now still stationed in Gaza, but otherwise it's held. There are the daily airstrikes have stopped. People aren't dodging bombs and drones and dying by the hundreds every day, or dozens at least. It's okay. I mean, there was a delay on Sunday, I think, because there was some concern about the delivery of the list of hostages that. October 7th hostages that Hamas was prepared to release in this first round of exchanges, but that was settled. The agreement came into effect a few hours later than it was originally supposed to, but it has stuck. There was an exchange of, I believe, 3 October 7th hostages, and Israel released 90 detainees, Palestinian detainees, on Sunday, the day the deal came into effect. There's supposed to be another exchange on Saturday. And in the meantime, there has been a surge of humanitarian aid into the territory. I believe, according to the United Nations, they were able to bring in 1,545 aid trucks into Gaza over just the first 2 days of the ceasefire. That is more than entered the territory over the first 10 days of January combined. So one thing you can say is that finally there's a reasonable amount of humanitarian aid getting into the territory. Another thing you can say is that clearly every last thing that the Biden administration or the Israeli government have said about humanitarian aid over the last 15 months was a lie. This was definitely Israeli obstruction and the conflict, the violence that prevented aid from getting into the territory. It was nothing about the inadequacy of relief organizations or any other of the smokescreen bullshit excuses that were lofted up to try and explain what was clearly a conscious choice to deny people of this in the territory food, water, medical aid, et cetera. So those are all positive things. We can talk about where things go from here, which I think is less positive, but I do think it's important to at least start there, start with the good news.
And I think it's important to underline that the Biden administration always had the power to do something like this. It chose not to do it, and it is responsible for the horrific and horrifying conditions in Gaza.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about this humanitarian surge.
Right. So as I said, the UN was able to bring in hundreds of trucks just in the first couple of days. I think that pace has more or less continued. I haven't seen data beyond the first 2 days. But the it's not just the amount of aid getting into the territory. Distributing it has become much easier, first and foremost, because there's nobody bombing or shooting at aid trucks. There's still the problem of destroyed roads to deal with, but that's easier to do when you're not being shot at, certainly. The concern now, I think, for aid agencies, so there's two concerns. One of them is it is winter, and they would like to bring in materials to construct more durable, still temporary, but more durable shelter for people who have lost their homes, been displaced, been living in tent cities around Gaza. The Israeli government is blocking a lot of that. They're blocking a lot of the kind of construction materials that you would need to do something like that, for the usual, you know, rationale that they, you know, that Hamas could turn these things into weapons, I guess. The other concern is that in a few days, the Israeli government's effective ban on the UN Relief and Works Agency, which is still the main organization distributing aid in Gaza, is going to come into effect. The Israeli Knesset passed legislation that effectively prevents it from working in Gaza. It really bans it from Israel, but the effect is the same. Back in October, and the implementation date is, I think, might be January 28th. So that's going to be an issue, whether UNRWA is going to be able to continue working or is going to be able to hand things off to some other organization. But it's certainly a complication that I'm sure the aid groups would rather not have to deal with right now.
And Hamas is back in control. How is that going?
This is an interesting point, because as I said, you know, the distribution of aid within Gaza has improved dramatically. And one of the reasons for that is because Hamas is back in control. Its law enforcement policing functions are now back in the open. You know, they're protecting convoys from looters who, you know, may or may not have connections to any outside powers that we won't talk about. But, you know, looting was a problem that the aid groups were dealing with. They're no longer having to deal with that, it seems. It's clear that the administration of Gaza under this temporary first phase of the ceasefire is in Hamas's hands. And I think one of the concerns or implications of that, which we'll talk about the prospects for the second phase of the ceasefire, but, you know, it can't look good for Benjamin Netanyahu and the Israeli government that you've spent 15 months claiming to be wiping out Hamas, and, you know, day one of the ceasefire, they're back out in the streets running Gaza effectively and taking care of security and all these types of things. That doesn't speak well to the war effort. And it also raises, of course, the question of, again, what this was all for. You know, if you had to pound Gaza and deprive people of food and water and basic living conditions to defeat Hamas, and you have done apparently very little to actually defeat Hamas based on what we've seen over the last few days, then what was it all for? Now, you know, we can say the killing itself was the point, which I think is true, but I'm sure that the Israelis and the U.S. government would reject that framing. And yet, you know, this is where we're sort of at.
I cannot believe they would reject that framing. It's just like, you're just in topsy-turvy land when you talk about this shit. Yes. What about this second phase and its potential?
This is where things get, I think, uncomfortable, at least, because the only deal that's really been implemented is this initial temporary 6-week ceasefire phase. Everything else in the negotiations and the ceasefire was left for future further negotiations to work out. So the idea that of a more permanent or at least indefinite cessation of hostilities, of an Israeli military withdrawal from Gaza, all the things that you would expect to maybe see some sort of reconstruction effort. All of these things were put off for future negotiations. The prospect of those things actually coming to fruition doesn't seem great. Benjamin Netanyahu has been telling anyone in Israel that he has no intention of moving to a second phase of the ceasefire. Now, that may be bluster for political reasons, but he does have a veto here as one of the two principals who would be negotiating on the second round. If he doesn't want a second round, there won't be a second round. Now, there could be pressure from the Trump administration. We know that pressure from the Trump administration, at least everybody involved in the talks has said that pressure from the incoming Trump administration was one of the keys to getting Israel to agree to the first phase of the ceasefire. So there may be pressure from the Trump administration to go to a second phase, although I have to say, in his first day on the job on Monday, Donald Trump told reporters at the White House that he's not confident, those were his words, that the ceasefire will last. So that's not terribly optimistic. He's also talking about turning Gaza into beachfront property again, which is not great news, I think, for anybody living there currently. And there's been a plan floated by his Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff, who was the man who exerted apparently pressure on Netanyahu to do the ceasefire. He's talked about partially relocating the population of Gaza to Indonesia during reconstruction, which I'm sure we could all see would be a step toward just outright permanent ethnic cleansing, and was also apparently news to the government of Indonesia, who hadn't heard anything about it and hadn't been talked to by Witkoff.
I just want to tangent some history here. This is similar to things like the Uganda plan with putting the Jews in Uganda and also various autonomous plans. So this is something that has been done throughout, or at least imagined throughout 20th century history, about way to get rid of a quote unquote problematic population. So I'm glad we're still doing that. Good stuff.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we're bringing it all back. We're bringing back the frontier when we buy Greenland, and we're bringing back, a lot of the great hits. So, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't blame anybody for not being optimistic about the longevity of this deal. That said, even a 6-week break is probably good news. The other detail here that may be of interest is that the commander of the Israeli military, Herzi Halevi, resigned his position on Tuesday, ostensibly to taking advantage of the fact that there's a lull in fighting, both in Lebanon and in Gaza, to accept some accountability for the October 7th, 2023 attacks, and the fact that the IDF was unable to prevent them and didn't respond terribly well when they initially started to take place. But what I've read, some of the behind the scenes aspects of this, or one in particular, is that Halevi knows that Netanyahu is not going to allow the ceasefire to go to a second phase and believes that it should be allowed to go to a second phase. And so he's leaving rather than having to be in charge of the Israeli military when the massacre resumes. His last day on the job is going to be March 6th, which, coincidentally or not, is the last day of this first phase of the ceasefire. So if there's going to be a resumption of hostilities, it would start probably on March 7th. So that's an interesting, an interesting tidbit. I don't know what else to make of it, except that, people are talking about it as further evidence that there's just not going to be, the Israeli government's just not interested in continuing this.
So actually, you mentioned him already, but let's talk about friend of the pod, Steve Witkoff, who is not only going to be Gaza negotiator, but he's also going to be in charge of the Iran file. So Derek, tell us a little bit about what's going on there.
This is just reported, I think, on Thursday, that Trump is going to hand the Iran file to Witkoff, which, we don't know a lot of detail here. We don't know if he's just structuring this to kind of funnel all of his plans and schemes for the Middle East through one guy, or if he's, so satisfied with the way Witkoff handled the Gaza ceasefire talks that he's just expanding his portfolio. I really can't speak to anything beyond the fact that it's been reported that this is happening. We can, I guess, talk about the possibility of renewed nuclear negotiations between the U.S. and Iran, which on the one hand, I think Trump would love to get a new nuclear deal done. I've said this to you before. I think that If you took the 2015 nuclear deal that he wadded up and tossed in the garbage can and resurrected it as the Trump deal, he would be thrilled to get that arrangement and trumpet it as a great diplomatic victory. So there is some possibility that he's looking to do that. The Iranian government, as it currently exists under the new president, relatively new president, Stoke Pezeshkian, has expressed openness to talks with the West, not necessarily with the U.S., but at least with the West. They've had some interactions with the so-called E3, the UK, France, and Germany, which is the European cadre that handles the nuclear file for the EU with Iran. European, I guess not the EU anymore with the UK, but still for Europe. So there is, you know, there is some potential movement here. I don't know that the Iranians are ready to engage with the United States, at least not openly. But we can certainly see where it goes. As I say, I think Trump would like to be able to say that he got a deal done here.
Let's move back to Israel for a second and talk about the new IDF operation in the West Bank.
This is, I think, another direct result of the ceasefire in Gaza, which has opened things up for the Israelis to refocus attention on the West Bank. And they've done that in Jenin over the past several days. Started earlier this week with a raid. They've killed, I think, at least 12 people at this point and have openly been talking about Israel Katz, the defense minister, the Israeli defense minister, is openly talking about applying what he called the lessons of Gaza to the West Bank. And Jenin and the northern part of the West Bank in particular have been hotbeds of sort of militant activity, especially militants affiliated maybe with Islamic Jihad or Hamas. Certainly outside the framework of the Palestinian Authority or the Fatah party, it has been something of a hotbed for that type of activity. But they're definitely doing things that are reminiscent of Gaza in Jenin. They're bulldozing roads, they're attacking hospitals. They have surrounded the refugee camp in Jenin or on the outskirts of Jenin. So taking a lot of, as Kat said, lessons from Gaza, it seems, in how they're approaching this in a comprehensive way. It's not just military, it's also humanitarian denial and those types of things. This seems like it's going to be the first stage of a bigger operation in the West Bank. That's the way Israeli officials seem to be talking about it. Whether they view this as a way to kill time before the resumption of hostilities in Gaza, or if it's, you know, Netanyahu appealing to the far right elements of his coalition, one of whom already quit, Itamar Ben-Gvir, the national security minister. He can't bring down the government because he doesn't have enough votes behind him. But he's preparing to go back into the coalition if the ceasefire lapses. So it might not be a long-term divorce. But nevertheless, Netanyahu has to be concerned about some of the other elements of his cabinet potentially quitting if they're not happy with the body count. And so he's maybe turned to the West Bank as a new front to just keep the churn going, keep the carnage going, and secure his position in office. I don't know. But this does seem like it's going to be a fairly significant West Bank operation for at least the next few weeks.
Let's stay in the region, but let's move on to Syria and talk about the government seems to be engaging in negotiations with the Syrian Democratic Forces.
These negotiations, I mean, they're related, obviously, to the tensions between the SDF and the Kurdish core of the SDF, the YPG militia, and Turkey and its rebel or militant factions, proxies, who have clashed around Manbij since the fall of the Bashar al-Assad government. And there's been threats from Turkey about a bigger invasion of northern Syria to deal with the SDF, which it regards as an arm of the Kurdistan Workers Party or PKK. The negotiations between the SDF and the Syrian government are supposed to forestall further Turkish action by bringing the SDF into the new Syrian government's security structure. But there are serious disagreements about how to do that. The SDF wants, as you might expect, the SDF wants to be basically incorporated into the Syrian security apparatus brought under the government's authority as a defined unit, as its own thing. within a broader military structure. The Syrian government is not having that at all. Defense Minister, the caretaker Defense Minister Marhaf Abulkasra, rejected that idea. What he wants to do with not just the SDF, but this also applies to factions in southern Syria, anybody who's out of the framework of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham and that rebel coalition, which now is in control. They want the SDF to be dissolved, and then its fighters could be brought in to the Syrian military as soldiers, as regular soldiers, but they would be, their unit structure, their cohesion would be torn apart in favor of just bringing them in piecemeal, and that's not what the SDF wants. So the negotiations are still going. They're supposedly, what I've read suggests that they're going fairly well, despite this this level of disagreement, at least well enough to probably forestall any serious military action from Turkey for the time being. We'll have to see how patient they are. There are, of course, developments happening in Turkey that may come to bear on that, which I think we'll talk about here in a moment. But this is certainly the biggest potential fault line for a resumption of serious conflict in Syria would be between the SDF and these Turkish proxies, Turkey itself, perhaps, and now, you know, possibly also the Syrian government, which again, Abulkasra, in his comments on how these negotiations are going, has said that the new authorities are prepared to use force against the SDF if they don't feel like they're getting anywhere in the talks. So this is still a very, very concerning potential conflict area.
But there seems to be good news, speaking of Turkey, in that there might be an actual thaw between the government and the PKK, the Kurds. So what's going on there, Derek?
This was reported on Wednesday. Several senior figures in the People's Equality and Democracy Party, which is the latest incarnation of a predominantly Kurdish, they've been, you know, they've tried to broaden their appeal beyond just being the Kurdish party. But it's the same general formation, predominantly Kurdish, leftist in orientation. But the People's Equality and Democracy Party, these leaders met with the imprisoned, he's been imprisoned for almost 26 years at this point, leader of the Kurdistan Workers Party, or PKK, Abdullah Öcalan, on Wednesday. This is the second time they've done that in the past 2 months. Now, last year, like October, November, there were a lot of rumors and some movement about the possibility of some kind of thaw between the Turkish government and the PKK that Öcalan would be instrumental in kind of bringing about. There were signs of reconciliation, for example, between this People's Equality and Democracy Party and the hard right nationalist MHP, which is the a coalition partner for Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's Justice and Development Party. So there's been some scuttlebutt about something potentially breaking here. The meeting on Wednesday sparked a lot of reporting that Öcalan is now prepared to essentially call on his fighters in the PKK to lay down their arms. Now, that could happen as soon as next month, which would be, I think, February 15th is the anniversary of his arrest and incarceration. It could happen a bit later, depending on how negotiations go. Another date I saw thrown out there was Nowruz, which is March 20th, 21st. But some on some, I guess, auspicious date, there's the possibility that Öcalan will make this announcement, in return for which the Turkish government will end his solitary confinement. It would free a number of other prominent jailed Turkish politicians, and it would promise to start the ball moving on a number of legal measures, constitutional measures even, that could benefit Turkey's Kurdish minority, like protection for the Kurdish language, that sort of thing. So this could be a huge development if it actually comes to fruition. I mean, you know, there have been moves toward a peace settlement between the PKK and the Turkish government in the past, and they've always gotten hung up on something or other. So it's never come to fruition. But if it did here, it would be huge for Turkey. It would be huge for northern Iraq, where the PKK is largely based and that deals with Turkish drone strikes on a regular basis. And it would have implications for this situation in Syria with the SDF. Muslim Abdi, the commander of the Syrian Democratic Forces, actually met earlier this month with Masoud Barzani, who's still the leader, basically, of the Kurdistan Democratic Party in Iraq and is a Turkish client, proxy, ally, friend, whatever term you want to use, met with him earlier this month in Erbil in Iraq. And it's clear now that this has been part of a bigger conversation that's going on between Turkey, between the Barzanis, between the SDF, the Syrian government, where you could see a settlement if the Öcalan peace comes to fruition and the PKK kind of that conflict ends, or at least, you know, tamps down. You could see the Syrian Democratic Forces agreeing to some sort of power sharing arrangement in northeastern Syria, which could remain somewhat autonomous as they have advocated, but they would be sharing power with the another Syrian Kurdish party, the Kurdish National Council, which has ties to the Barzanis, to the Kurdistan Democratic Party, and is much more acceptable, shall we say, to the Turkish government. So this could all be part of a big regional political realignment that that would fend off the possibility, as I said, of this conflict in Syria, and also maybe end the war with between Turkey and the PKK.
Lots of interesting stuff happening in the Middle East. Especially, it'll be interesting to see as the United States, I think, does genuinely try to draw back a little bit. Let's move on to a country that is often mistakenly said to be in the Middle East, and that is Afghanistan, where Trump's executive order has stranded refugees.
One of several executive orders that Trump issued on his first day in office suspended refugee admissions to the United States for at least the next 4 months. And that includes people who have been vetted, have been cleared to come to the U.S., people who literally may have had plane tickets to come to the U.S. And there's no population more affected by this than the thousands of Afghan nationals who have been waiting more patiently than, frankly, they should probably have had to wait for permission to enter the U.S. since the return of the Taliban to power in Afghanistan and the withdrawal of the U.S. military. The plan was always to support Afghan nationals who worked with the U.S. military, who worked alongside the U.S. military. In some cases, there are family members of U.S. Military personnel who are stuck because of this order now. But by and large, these are people who I don't know how many of them are still in Afghanistan. Most of them, I think, have fled to other countries, Pakistan being the main receiver. But these are people who are at serious risk of reprisal from the Taliban-led government in Afghanistan, and you know, because of the service that they performed on the U.S. behalf. But this order stops them from coming to the U.S. There were, I think, 1,660 Afghans who'd been cleared by the U.S. to come in, and then thousands more who are still waiting for their clearance, which, frankly, it's an embarrassment that it's taken this long. And so they are now in limbo. There's a possibility that Trump will resume refugee admissions in 4 months after some sort of review of the program or review of the way people have been vetted. I think that's probably unlikely given his general attitude towards foreign nationals, but anything's possible, I guess. But in the meantime, these people just don't know what they're doing. As I said, many of them have left Afghanistan, but they're stuck in situations in places like Pakistan, I think the Philippines as well, where they're not particularly well treated. They're not particularly welcome, especially in Pakistan. It's really a terrible situation that they've been put in. It's not all on Trump. It's not all on this order. They should have already been brought to the U.S. probably, but it's still very troubling.
And that truism of international politics remains accurate. Never trust the United States ever. Let's move on to Myanmar, where China has brokered a new ceasefire.
The Chinese government announced on Monday that it has mediated a ceasefire between the Myanmar's ruling junta and one of the country's major rebel groups, the Myanmar National Democratic Alliance Army. The MNDAA is part of the Three Brotherhood Rebel Coalition, or Three Brotherhood Alliance, that we've talked about in the past, that those groups, the MNDAA and the Tong National Liberation Army and the Arakan Army, launched a major operation, major offensive against the junta in October of 2023, and they have taken significant territory. The Tong National Liberation Army and the Myanmar National Democratic Alliance Army are both active in Shan State, and they now occupy or control big chunks of territory along the Chinese border, which is why China is interested in getting ceasefires in place in these conflicts. The Arakan Army Group is active in Rakhine State, which is somewhat out of, in a different part of the country in the West, so it's somewhat out of the picture here. But the Chinese government has been brokering talks between the junta and the MNDAA, as well as the Tong National Liberation Army. The former apparently has advanced faster than the latter. So the MNDAA announced, or the Chinese government rather announced this week that they had successfully secured a ceasefire. We'll have to see how the talks with the Tong group go. But this is at least a partial success for Beijing.
Let's move over to Africa and let's talk about the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where there's been a new M23 advance.
M23 has been, as we've talked about in the past, advancing through parts of the eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo, particularly North Kivu province. They've moved in recent weeks into neighboring South Kivu province. And on Tuesday, the Congolese government confirmed that they had lost control, or that the rebels had taken control of the town of Minova, which is located in South Kivu province. It lies along Lake Kivu and has been a conduit for both commercial goods and humanitarian aid getting into the capital of North Kivu province, the city of Goma. Now, Goma has been an M23 target during their last uprising several years ago. They are sort of at this point surrounding the city and could potentially start tightening their perimeter around the city, especially now that they've kind of taken Minova, which is, as I said, was an important conduit for shipments of goods into the city. Goma is home to, in the last Congolese census, was home to about 2 million people, and its population has swelled over the past couple of years, partly because of this conflict, as hundreds of thousands of displaced people from other parts of the region have come, kind of flocked there to seek shelter. So an advance on it could generate displacement in a much bigger magnitude than even what this region has seen so far. And it's been pretty heavy just over the last couple of weeks. The UN says this fighting in Minova and elsewhere has displaced around 178,000 people. So, looking at this as a major potential displacement crisis if it continues.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Thanks, Derek. Let's move on to Trump's Russia policy. And finally, someone is standing up to the bully Vladimir Putin, who has sanctioned so many innocents in his reign of terror.
He's really
the world.
Run amok. Yeah.
So talk about these new sanctions that Trump has threatened.
So Trump took to social media on Wednesday to urge Vladimir Putin to stop this ridiculous war. That was his quote. I don't think he said anything specifically about demanding that he lift sanctions on Daniel Bessner, but it's possible it was buried in there somewhere. But he also threatened if Putin doesn't stop this ridiculous war, that he will put high levels of taxes. I'm quoting him again here. Put high levels of taxes, tariffs, and sanctions on anything being sold by Russia to the United States and various other participating countries. There was some good Trumpian random capitalization in there and all kinds of things. He went on to sort of insist that Putin talk to him so they can end the Ukraine war in what he called the easy way. Said it's time to make a deal. So I'm sure Putin is looking at this and really taking it on board, and we'll have a settlement very soon. I think it's interesting to observe the direction that Trump's approach to Ukraine, or the way he's talked about the Ukraine conflict, has gone over the last several months. I'm sure you recall during the campaign, he talked about ending the war like within 24 hours of taking office, which probably would have involved demanding that Ukraine essentially surrender or do a deal entirely on Russian terms. But as the election got closer, and then after the election, it became more clear that Trump could win, and then when he did win, the rhetoric shifted in a pretty major way, and he and his people went from talking about 24 hours to talking about 100 days or 6 months. And now it looks like we're talking about just doing more of the same, basically sanctioning Russia. And he's talked about continuing to supply weapons to Ukraine. So it sounds like we're talking about just keeping the same policies in place. Now, who knows if he'll tweak them in one way or another to ratchet things up or ratchet things down. We don't know. But it doesn't seem like the quick resolution to the war is on the table anymore.
So it seems friend of the pod, NATO, might be increasing defense spending. Is that true?
I think it's probably true. There's a lot of excitement about this, actually. Like, the one person in Europe who we know is very enthusiastic about Donald Trump coming back to the White House is the Secretary General of NATO, Mark Rutte, who has been pushing for higher levels of defense spending. Now, NATO as people probably know, has a recommended floor for member states' military spending of 2% of GDP, and most of the alliance doesn't hit that mark. Trump, when he was in office the first time, was very angry about this and treated this 2% suggestion as basically like membership dues to get into NATO and be part of the club, which it's not. But that seemed to be the way he interpreted it, and so he was constantly demanding, which is not, was not unique. A lot of U.S. presidents in recent decades have been hemming a bit about European levels of defense spending and the reliance on the U.S. as Europe's security blanket, and demanding burden sharing, let's say, on the part of European allies. But Trump was more explicit about it. He was more open about it. And now, I think at the time he was demanding, everybody hit the 2% line and maybe go above that. But now he's come in with this idea that all NATO members should spend at least 5% of GDP on defense. That's a number that even the U.S., which is drunk on military power, does not come really close to hitting. I think we're at 3.1 or 3.2%. So it's unclear whether he actually means this or if he's just throwing out a big number and we'll settle for something less. Rutte and some other European leaders, but Rutte in particular has been the most enthusiastic about this, have been talking about 3%, 3.5% of GDP, citing this supposed threat from Russia to, march all over Europe, even though it's been stymied basically in eastern Ukraine. Nevertheless, I guess the threat is always there. So they've been talking about ratcheting up defense spending as well. And Trump gives them another bit of leverage to talk about this. Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, has also waded into this with the warning that Trump might pull the U.S. out of NATO, which I don't think is likely, but also that he might redeploy U.S. forces out of Europe, which I think is more likely, and that Europe needs to be prepared to defend itself, and that higher levels of defense spending are going to be required for that. So who knows? I mean, we'll see what happens here. I think there was a piece in World Politics Review a few days ago, I think maybe last week, which I thought was right, that if you're going to do this, that if Trump really wants to reduce the U.S. commitment in Europe and get Europeans to pay for their own defense, what he should do is not throw around numbers like 5% of GDP and demand that everybody hit that line. What he should do is announce the redeployment, say we're moving assets out of Europe and we're going to put them someplace else, and then let the Europeans worry about how they fill that gap. But who knows?
Let's move over to the Western Hemisphere and talk about Colombia, which the government of Colombia has broken off peace talks with the ELN.
There's been a very serious increase in fighting, apparently, in parts of especially northeastern Colombia, the Catatumbo region, which is somewhat infamous, I guess, in the drug trafficking and manufacture sectors, between the National Liberation Army, or ELN, and factions of ex-Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC fighters. Over basically turf, you know, it's basically a turf war between these groups, and not just between the ELN and these ex-FARC factions. The ex-FARC factions also fight among themselves. At least 100 people, I think, was the latest figure I saw, have been killed in this fighting since Thursday. Most of it in fighting between the ELN and various FARC factions, but internal, it's not really internal, but fighting among the FARC factions has killed a number of people as well. Over 30,000 people have been displaced by the violence. So very serious escalations here. And yes, as you said, Danny, Gustavo Petro suspended peace talks between his government and the National Liberation Army on Thursday in response to this upsurge in violence. He's also dispatched Colombian special forces to Catatumbo to, I guess, try to get a handle on things. But this is definitely something to continue to watch. And it's a big blow to Petro's ongoing effort to resolve all of Colombia's various militant conflicts. ELN remains the biggest since the FARC deal that kind of ended that rebellion and broke that group up into factions that came in and made peace with the government, factions that have not or have since rejected the peace deal. But ELN now stands as the largest rebel group in Colombia. So if there's going to be, if Petro's going to make any meaningful progress in ending these conflicts with rebels, with right-wing militant guerrilla groups, with drug gangs, et cetera, if he can't get a deal done with ELN, it's not going to mean all that much, I think.
Thank you, Derek. So as we've talked about before, Trump has grand plans for deporting people. And we've kind of talked about the contradictions of that in a special with Alex Avina. So if anyone wants details, check that out. But how have the governments of Mexico and Honduras been reacting to Trump's deportation plans, Derek?
Yeah, this is just early stuff. But the Honduran government is actually threatening to expel the U.S. military from the Sotocano Air Base, which is U.S. Southern Command's main hub in Central America, if Trump goes ahead with this sort of mass deportation plan, which could see upwards of 250,000 Honduran nationals suddenly, kind of return to that country, which would be a huge blow for Honduras to try to accommodate economically, socially. It would be a really major major thing. So she's the Honduran president, Xiomara Castro, is as I said, threatening to expel the U.S. military. I don't think she can follow through on this because the potential for economic repercussions from Trump is pretty high. But I think even the fact that she made the threat indicates how seriously they're taking this possibility of mass deportation and what it could mean for Honduras. In Mexico, it's a little bit more political, I guess. But one of Trump's executive orders on Monday was announced a restoration of the Remain in Mexico program. The Remain in Mexico program basically forced asylum seekers at the southern border to stay in Mexico, whether they're Mexican or not. Just anybody who was seeking asylum in the U.S. had to stay in Mexico while their asylum cases were heard. This was something that Trump did in his first term with the cooperation of the Mexican government. But this time around, he announced the return of the Remain in Mexico program, apparently without consulting anyone in the Mexican government. And Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum on Wednesday told reporters that no matter what executive orders Donald Trump might issue, her government has not agreed to reinstate the Remain in Mexico program for non-Mexican asylum seekers. It could, I guess, negotiate something with the U.S. government to agree to that, but it hasn't done that yet. And presumably you would think the Mexican government gets some say in whether or not it has to act as the waiting room for the U.S. asylum system. But I don't know that Trump sees it that way.
So, Derek, in a huge surprise, Oxfam has released a report indicating that inequality has increased. Could you tell us about this?
Yeah, I think the framing is all wrong here. We should be celebrating our billionaires.
They wouldn't have the money if they didn't deserve it. They wouldn't have it
right.
If they weren't geniuses.
If they weren't good people who were not just smarter and better and harder working than everybody else, but also better people morally, they wouldn't have all that money. And so I'm pleased to say that according to Oxfam, their wealth collectively of the world's billionaires rose by around $2 trillion in 2024, which is around $5.7 billion a day and three times faster than it rose in 2023.
We're doing it, Finn.
It's really great. I mean, I think it's fantastic. Now, they did suggest to my point about these people being better and smarter and harder working, that a lot of that comes from inheritance rather than any effort on the part of the actual billionaires. I think around a third of it, maybe a little bit more, they found. So I guess that's a little bit of a drag on the meritocratic piece of this. But, you know, otherwise, I think, you know, we're doing great. And you know, they raised a number of, to me, unrelated details, like the fact that around 44% of the world's population lives at or below the poverty line, which is considered to be $6 or 85 cents a day in income. 10% of all women live in extreme poverty, which is below $2.15 a day. I get why people, the do-gooders and hippies want to focus on that. But frankly, we should be getting the pie higher at the top, I think. And that's what this report says we're doing. So it's great success.
Good job, everyone. So, Derek, I don't know if you know, but 5 years ago, a young up-and-coming writer wrote for Jacobin magazine an article titled, quote, "As president, Bernie Sanders should use executive orders aggressively, just like FDR did." Unfortunately, Bernie lost and Donald Trump is president, but Donald Trump is doing precisely what one should do if one wanted to actually move the ship of state in various directions, evil as they may be. So, Derek, tell us about Trump's executive orders.
He issued 26 of them on Monday, which is a pretty whopping total. It's easily higher than the number issued by any of his predecessors, including the first Donald Trump administration on day one. I mean, you know, there will be certainly more executive orders to come, but in terms of day one inauguration day executive orders, he's lapped the field at this point. We've talked about a few of them, like the Remain in Mexico, the immigration stuff. There were other decisions. The first order, I think, he issued rescinded dozens of Joe Biden's executive orders en masse. And so that included putting Cuba back on the state sponsors of terrorism list, which I'm not even sure we talked about on this program because it happened so briefly that it didn't matter.
We talked about it actually in our inauguration bonus episode coming out on Sunday. Yeah, so people check that out.
But yeah, it lasted, you know, literally a matter of a couple of days before Trump undid it. He also, some of them are just silly, like he issued an executive order renaming the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America, reverting Denali, the mountain in Alaska, back to its former name of Mount McKinley. Barack Obama had changed it to Denali, I think, in 2015 or sometime during his administration. He pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement again, which, you know, you may or may not find significant. The Paris Climate Agreement is really a dead letter at this point, but it does indicate that Donald Trump, as you would expect, is going to be a disaster for the environment and climate change. He withdrew the U.S. from the World Health Organization, or at least began the process of withdrawing from the World Health Organization. This is something Trump did toward the end of his first term, but Biden undid. There wasn't enough time left in Trump's term for it to go into effect, and Biden was able to step in and reverse it. So Trump has done that again. which could cost the WHO around one-fifth of its funding. The Chinese government has already pledged to step in and support the organization. I don't know if it means to make up the entire loss of revenue from the U.S., but given the Trump's complaint about the WHO during the COVID fiasco was that the WHO is too beholden to China, I think leaving it even more dependent on Chinese funding than before is just a brilliant brilliant move on his part. It's 11th dimensional chess, frankly. And then, you know, one of the serious ones, we can also talk about what he didn't do. He didn't impose any tariffs on day one, which he had threatened to do. He's talked about imposing 25% tariffs on imports from Mexico and Canada as soon as February 1st now, unless both of them agree to renegotiate the U.S.-Mexico-Canada free trade agreement, which Donald Trump negotiated, but is apparently not happy with its terms now. He's also threatening, of course, very punitive sanctions on Chinese imports. He's now tied that to the whole TikTok saga in suggesting that the tariffs could be avoided if China agrees to sell 50% or more of the TikTok app to a U.S. buyer. So there's a lot of that on the table. The one that stood out to me, the executive order that stood out to me as potentially the most serious from a foreign policy perspective, was he ordered the U.S. State Department, or gave the U.S. State Department latitude to put Mexican cartels on the Foreign Terrorist Organization list. Now, this can have a range of impacts from, you know, fairly ineffectual economic you know, kind of measures or economic penalties to more serious economic penalties, which really, given the economic activity of the cartels in Mexico, could have some repercussions for U.S. companies, to more serious things like expanding law enforcement's capabilities to deal with these cartels, which, again, are in a foreign country, or even authorizing a military incursion into Mexico to combat the cartels if he wanted to go that far. I'm not sure he does, but it does, you know, potentially open the door to military aspects as well. So I think that's one in particular to be very cognizant of moving forward.
Well, Derek, another week, another news episode. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And as always, keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
Bye.
This episode is brought to you by The Syllabus, a nonprofit knowledge discovery service doing artisanal automation. How does that work? Well, they use technology to monitor thousands of sources, and each week, human curators, that is actual people, handpick the best of what's been published on the internet. When you sign up, you get to set up your feed. You'll pick from 6 languages and 60 topics like far-right populism or energy and extractivism, heterodox economics or AI and automation. Everything's there. Each Monday, you'll get a new batch of personalized recommendations. And it's not just podcasts. It's essays and books, academic articles and reports, and even videos. And I believe, dear friends, that American Prestige and even maybe Daniel Bessner himself has been featured on The Syllabus. So check out their website, the-syllabus.com. And there's a hyphen between the and syllabus. That was the dash I said. They offer 2-week free trials, and if you enter Prestige at checkout, you'll get 30% off your first year. And to remember, that's Prestige, P-R-E-S-T-I-G-E, and you enter that at checkout for 30% off your first year.